Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. In a very interesting discussion, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo opens up about Venezuelan opposition, says keeping it united has proven devilishly difficult, while opposition leader Juan Guaido has been seizing control of state assets to starve government funding. The saga in Venezuela continues, even though it's not on the front pages of American media. And for insight into this, we turn to my first guests. She is with the campaign to end U.S. and Canadian sanctions against Venezuela, Terry Madsen. Terry, welcome back.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And we're also joined by a political analyst and editor at Venezuelan Analysis, Ricardo Vaz. Ricardo, as always, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again. Always a pleasure.
So during a closed-door meeting in New York last week with Jewish leaders, Secretary Pompeo spoke honestly about the challenges the Trump administration is facing in their attempts to overthrow the democratically elected president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro. The U.S. narrative has been that the opposition is strong, united, and legitimate. In this meeting, Pompeo admits, quote, "Our conundrum, which is to keep the opposition united, has proven devilishly difficult. The moment Maduro leaves, everybody's going to raise their hands and say, take me, I'm the next president of Venezuela. It would be 40-plus people who believe they're the rightful heir to Maduro," end quote. Terry, your thoughts on this revelation. Does it surprise you that Pompeo was as clear about the problems they're facing as he was with this meeting last week in New York?
Well, I think the only person who doesn't know the opposition is not united is Mike Pompeo. I think, you know, here in throughout the states, many of us, and most certainly within Venezuela and throughout Latin America, it's pretty well known that the opposition has never been united the way it's been framed to be united by the U.S. State Department. So it's a relief that he's finally cluing in, but it's also a little alarming that the U.S. government either didn't know what is truly happening on the ground in Venezuela, or if it did know, chose to ignore it. But this is not news to anybody who has followed Venezuela, particularly in the last 20 years. The opposition has never been united.
Ricardo, a same question to you, and adding this question, who chose whom? Did the United States choose Guaido? Did Guaido approach the United States? I'm wondering, did Guaido sell the United States a bill of goods that they just blindly bought? So same question to you with that additional question added.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think it's incredibly funny that Pompeo would say this so candidly and not keep his cards a bit closer to his chest. But yes, what Terry says is absolutely correct. I mean, it's been one of the most open secrets in Venezuela, the lack of unity in the opposition. And in fact, we've discussed this here on the show, you know,
yes,
how Guaido's self-proclamation caught part of the opposition by surprise, how this sudden dialogue initiative in Norway was also perhaps a sign that some fractions of the opposition were starting to move against Guaido. And also, I mean, the issues that these opposition leaders, it's exactly like Pompeo says, you know, they're just, you know, raising their hands and asking for the U.S. to pick them. It really says a lot, not just that the U.S. and Pompeo in particular believes that it's their role to choose the leader of Venezuela, but also that these opposition leaders think that somehow it's their rightful heir, you know, rightful heir, their rightful heritage to become the president of Venezuela. Going towards your question, I think it was kind of a conjunction of two factors. You know, on one hand, you had a lot of these opposition leaders who had lost all credibility precisely because they could not get themselves on the same page. They could not agree on anything. And so they gradually lost credibility in the midst of a very severe economic crisis. And so the U.S. was clearly looking for someone new. And this has been reported in other in other articles that somehow their strategy was in place, but they were missing, that there was a missing piece, and Guaido was also was precisely that missing piece, you know, so very brazenly admitting their role orchestrating all of this. And so they kind of knew that with the turn of the year, there was going to be a new presidency in the National Assembly, and so Guaido was, in a way, next in line. So they had been grooming Guaido ever since, well, more intensely ever since around October when he started touring the U.S. and Latin America. But he was already someone that they had groomed. You know, he had studied in the U.S. He was very close to these think tanks and so on. But he was one among many. You know, there are many figures like him that emerged in this 2007 generation. But then, you know, as time got closer to the end of the year, he became clearly the next opposition leader in the eyes of the State Department.
And let me say for the audience, Ricardo, you're joining us from Caracas. So and Terry, you just got back. So you all are very, very, very close to the sentiments and feelings that are on the ground. Terry, in listening to Ricardo's answer, this just kind of popped in my head. It sounds as though the United States, in their intervention in Venezuela, is consistent with how American foreign policy seems to be formulated on so many fronts, and that is they don't really care about culture. They don't care about tradition. They don't really care about the sensitivities on the ground. They just kind of go in like a bull in a china shop. This is America. This is what we're going to do. And we don't really care about how you all function and operate.
Well, I would agree with that, and I think it's the same template, the same playbook that's been in use since 1953 in Iran. And the arrogance of ignoring the ground conditions or even incompetency in failing to evaluate ground conditions correctly is a real fallacy on the United States government. It's a cultural fallacy, and it's a political and it's a military fallacy. I would just share with you, as you know, Ricardo, too, I think you're aware that my initial weeks in Venezuela in late March, I had brought a delegation of 14 people to Venezuela to study the effects of the sanctions, to learn what they are, how the government's responding, and how communities are adapting and responding. And the first thing, we had varying degrees of knowledge, which was the point of the trip, was to increase people's knowledge. So we had people from 25 years of age to 75 years of age, some with intense experience in Venezuela and some with relatively little. But across the spectrum, the very first thing people began to realize and comment on that delegation was how calm things were on the street, how friendly people were, that if it was a country waiting to erupt into civil war, you would feel a lot of tension with eye contact and body language. There are things you would feel walking the streets. There are things you would feel from Venezuela citizens getting onto the metro. Instead, you feel people are relatively relaxed given, you know, the issues they're up against, but people are still friendly and talkative. And all of us came to a conclusion on our own that this is not a country on the verge of civil war. This is not a country united against Guaido. And how in the heck did the U.S. State Department get it so wrong? If it was there for us, of varying degrees of experience and knowledge, to readily see and experience, how is it that the U.S. government was not seeing that and interpreting it the same way we were? I mean, they didn't want to, if they were aware of it, they most certainly didn't want to interpret it the way we did. And so, yes, I would agree with you that there is this whole paradigm of arrogance that goes into putting that whole regime change agenda into place, regardless of conditions on the ground. And what a devastation we saw in Iraq with not understanding the ground conditions. And everywhere else.
And just to quickly put a bow around that, and is a totally unrelated example, but I think it demonstrates culture. My first time in Iran, I noticed that men weren't wearing neckties. And so I'm getting ready to go do some press TV in their studio, and I'm trying to decide about which tie to wear. And I happened to ask my interpreter, I said, "Hey, man, how come I don't see people wearing neckties here?" And he said, "Well, because that is interpreted by many here to be a sign of imperialism and arrogance, imperialist arrogance."
Yeah.
And he said, "I'd suggest you not wear a tie." I said, hey, I said, thank you for that insight. And I didn't wear a tie.
You didn't? Yeah.
No. Carlos, Pompeo went on to say, we're trying to support various religious institutions to get the opposition to come together. Then he went on to say, you should know Maduro is mostly surrounded by Cubans. He doesn't trust Venezuelans a lick. I don't blame him. He shouldn't. They're all plotting against him. Sadly, they were all plotting for themselves. And then he went on to say, Cubans are at the heart of the economic woes that, frankly, if you are worried about religious freedom, also at the greatest risk of continuing to be religiously intolerant. And then I couldn't understand what the rest of the sentence was, but because I listened to the audio. But if you could talk about the point about trying to get the church and religious organizations behind the opposition and his assessment that President Maduro is surrounded by Cubans because he doesn't trust Venezuelans.
Yeah, so the first part probably has to do with what his audience was when this audio was leaked. But it has been an effort by the opposition to try and get, especially the Catholic Church, to back them. So the religious authorities here in Venezuela are, you know, as you would expect, very much against the government. But the Catholic Church, which, you know, in a largely Catholic country still holds a lot of weight, has largely tried to stay away and to, you know, advocate for dialogue and so on. And so one of the opposition efforts and U.S. efforts, as you'd expect, has been to try and get the Catholic Church to be more forceful on the side of the opposition. As to the comment about the Cubans, I mean, that's the kind of a reheated Cold War argument that you'd expect from these people like John Bolton and Mike Pompeo as well. I mean, that there's no evidence about it, but since the Cuban boogeyman has been, I mean, there's been a lot of effort after so many decades of the Cuban Revolution to demonize Cuba, that you can just transpose it and say that, you know, all the evils that befall Venezuela are the fault of the Cubans, and then you already have a propaganda machinery that's ready. I mean, there was Marco Rubio is the most, you know, the most prolific in this kind of outlandish, idiotic claims. Once he posted a picture on Twitter that had, I think it was a defense minister and some other people around the table discussing, and there was a security man on the door, and he just drew a circle around this guy and put an arrow saying Cuban agent. You know, that's the kind of evidence that we're dealing with.
Terry, same question to you.
Well, I would say, just as far as, you know, commenting about the Cubans and this whole Cold War paradigm that's been restoked by the U.S. State Department and Congress. If you look at the composition, the demographic composition of both of those institutions in the United States, and then you look at the composition of, say, the Venezuelan Foreign Ministry, and Ricardo, you can attest to this as well, the Venezuelan Foreign Ministry is a whole new generation of internationalists. These people, men and women, are, well, I use the word young in comparison to those institutions in the United States. I think they're all, I would guess they're all under 55, probably the majority of them under 50. They are approaching, you know, the international world, their responsibilities in a much different paradigm. And I would argue, a much more progressive geopolitics than anyone is quite possible of doing, with the exception of a handful, are possible of doing in Washington right now. You know, it's almost, just for me, given my generation, I look at, you know, just straddling both countries, you kind of look at the U.S. and you see these people holding on to this post-World War II paradigm, and then you look at this new generation of foreign ministers and Venezuela, and they're coming from a completely different generational perspective and experience. These people have grown up in the Bolivarian Revolution. You have people running the United States State Department who are still stuck in a post-World War II paradigm. And I don't know how you balance that. It's, you know, you have people talking past each other generationally almost. I mean, it's just impossible for Washington to really grasp, I think, what's really happening in Venezuela on the ground. I think it's really hard because they're operating in, you know, an old paradigm.
Pompeo went on to say that the difficulty of uniting the opposition has not only played out in, quote, public for these last months, but since the day I became CIA director, this was something that was at the center of what President Trump was trying to do. I found it interesting that Pompeo did not elaborate further in saying that this is really not only Trump policy, this has been U.S. policy from at least the George W. Bush administration. Ricardo, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, as Terry had said in the beginning, this has been an issue for 20 years. And what's most startling, or at least maybe we shouldn't be surprised given, you know, this mix of arrogance and incompetence, is that despite there being no signs at all that there was any more unity in the opposition now or a few months ago than there had historically been, the U.S. still decided to go all in this idea of, you know, allowing or even pushing Guaido to proclaim himself president. So I think it's a policy that is not only marred by this old Cold War paradigm, as Terry was just describing, it's also very short-sighted, you know. They somehow wanted a quick victory, and someone told them this was in their grasp. And I think Guaido also has a responsibility in that. I mean, there was some report, which was not confirmed, that Mike Pence had actually chided Guaido after the February 23rd incident in the border, because Guaido had supposedly promised that the armed forces were going to break much more easily than they did, and they haven't so far. And just to comment on what Terry was saying, yeah, this internationalist outlook has been one of the key components of the Bolivarian Revolution, you know, trying to come up with a new paradigm for international relations, breaking away from U.S. hegemony. And when we think about, you know, the U.S. foreign policy being stuck, I mean, there's no better example than the Trump administration dusting off Elliot Abrams and bringing him back into the fold, right? I mean, how much more blatant can it get?
That's a very, very good point. Terry, your thoughts?
I just want to just touch on something Ricardo brought up, you know, the Venezuelan military. And I think that was another, you know, big misread, you know, in Washington, D.C., is not understanding the Bolivarian military. And that, unlike many other countries in Latin America, you know, the Venezuelan military is of the people. In other Latin American countries, the military tends to be of the oligarchy, the business class, you know, serving to protect their interests. In Venezuela, it's quite the opposite. And so the military has not shifted to the opposition. And again, that should be no surprise to anyone in Washington, if they really understood.
Terry, let me jump in there and ask you this and let Ricardo respond as well. To your point about the military being of the people, what the United States knows as its National Guard is, as I understand it, in Venezuela, an armed group of actual citizens who will come to the town square, I'll use that metaphor, in defense of their country if necessary. Is that a fair statement to make?
That's the purpose of its creation, and you can see that. And I think if you're referring to the militia, the civilian militia.
Yes, I am.
Okay, so that is something. Yes, and I have been at Miraflores with people of varying, you know, community militias, and in the Plaza Bolivar and elsewhere in Venezuela. And yes, it's a huge sense of civic responsibility and community responsibility, but also what is happening with the enthusiasm in that those groups is that this rhetoric coming out of Washington, D.C. has created an enormous sense of national sovereignty. People are Venezuelans first, at least those who are of more moderate politics. People are Venezuelans first and political parties second. And that was very, very overt in my experiences, particularly at rallies where the civil militia was very, very present. You can really feel they're Venezuelans first. And that has been created, I believe, and Ricardo, you could probably speak to this better than me, I think that this resurgence of nationality has been created by Washington, D.C.
Ricardo, your thoughts to Terry's comment.
Yeah, Terry's right. And so this new perspective on the armed forces, it became more prominent after the failed military coup in 2002. So, and it also has to do with the fact that Chavez came from a military background. So he was perhaps perfectly positioned to understand that there needed to be a new way of organizing the armed forces with precisely this, not just internationalist, but very patriotic concept of what the armed forces should be. And Chavez had the great merit of actually connecting this all the way back to Bolivar. So that has created a very, very solid ideological component in the armed forces, which should not blind us to the fact that the armed forces also have their interests. I mean, they run sectors of the economy, and one thing doesn't rule out the other. And going back to what you were saying, yeah, the militia is another creation that comes a few years later, precisely on this idea that, you know, the people should defend themselves and not just rely on a traditional, you know, army as we are used to think. And so it goes to the goes back to this kind of profound misunderstanding of lack of will or lack of will to understand how Venezuela works, that somehow didn't factor into this incredibly destructive and short-sighted U.S. foreign policy.
Ricardo, I'd like for you to talk about the Monomeros Fertilizer Company and how it's being reported that Guaido is taking over the fertilizer company, which operates out of Colombia, the same way that he took control of U.S. oil refiner Citgo in a bid to starve the Maduro government of funding and prohibit or inhibit the Maduro government's ability to take care of the Venezuelan people.
Yeah, so this is something that Terry will also be able to explain quite well. So one of the dimensions of the U.S. sanctions and, you know, kind of general financial blockade has been the seizure of Venezuelan assets held abroad. And so perhaps the most important example is precisely Citgo. Citgo is the subsidiary of the state oil company PDVSA in the United States, and it owns, I think, three refineries. And Monomeros, the one you were discussing, is the subsidiary of the state petrochemical company PEC-UN. And as the, you know, there was a Financial Times article about this, it's quite a significant company in Colombia. And so Juan Guaido has been unable to make any inroads in, you know, holding on to anything within Venezuelan borders, but with the help of the US and allied countries such as Colombia, it has managed to kind of seize these assets. It's not clear to what extent these kinds of funds are available to him, and to what extent they're just simply frozen as a way to, as you were pointing out in the question, to starve the Maduro government of resources. But, you know, that's clearly the plan. And just to wrap up on this issue of Monomeros, this was not reported in the Financial Times. I'm not sure if by ignorance or by coincidence, but two of the directors appointed by Guaido are people who were fired from PDVSA, from the state oil company, in 2002, 2003, because they were involved in this significant oil sabotage that had the intent of bringing down the Chavez government at the time.
Terry Matson, your thoughts, and adding to that how this Monomeros is based in Colombia, and President Maduro is concerned because he is accusing the Colombian government, those in Bogota, of working with the United States to overthrow his government.
Well, in this regard, I think they probably obviously are, in just the fact that they've done nothing to stop the seizure of the company. And so it's a kind of a passive-aggressive relationship. It's a regime change without sending in troops from the Colombian side of the border. But, you know, it's also interesting that this is a fertilizer. And, of course, that's needed to develop industrial agriculture in Venezuela as well. So seizing of the assets and reappointing them to Guaido is part of it. I think there's a food production component in that particular company as well. And also, I think it's really, really important while we're talking about seizure of assets being given to the Guaido, quote unquote, government, we can't forget what happened with the embassy in Washington, D.C., and that has been, that's sovereign Venezuelan territory that's been taken from the Maduro government by the United States and given to the Guaido government. And I also think we're going to have to watch and see what happens to the Venezuelan embassy in Ottawa, Canada, after Victoria Freeland's statement this weekend saying that the Canadians are going to cease operation of their embassy in Caracas. So there's more asset seizures coming, I'm afraid.
Terry Matson with the campaign to end U.S. and Canadian sanctions against Venezuela. Thank you. And Ricardo Voss, a political analyst and editor at Venezuelan Analysis, thank you as well for your contribution to the Critical Hour.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you both so much. All right, folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, speaking ahead of his trip to Normandy, President Trump said he made clear to Mexico that he was prepared to follow through on his threat to levy 5% tariffs on Mexican imports starting June 10th, raising to 25% by October. But he added, quote, "We're having a great talk with Mexico. Something pretty dramatic could happen," end quote. This is a marked change from his tone yesterday or last night when he tweeted that not nearly enough progress had been made. Now, I've been asking, is the threat of further tariffs a negotiating ploy? Well, all of this while the New York Times today published analysis on which states will be hit hardest by Trump's tariffs on Mexico. Well, for insight into this, we go to my next guest. He's Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, Dr. Linwood Taheed. Linwood, man, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you, Dr. Leon. Good to be here.
So first to where we are with the negotiations. Mexico's foreign minister, Marcelo Ebrard, said today that he believed the talks were advancing, this according to Reuters, while Mexican President Andres Manuel López Obrador says that he's optimistic a deal to avert tariffs could be reached. He called on Mexicans to flock to a friendship rally in the border city of Tijuana on Saturday. Your thoughts, do you have any insight in terms of what's going on right now with these negotiations?
Well, as much as anyone can have any insight about what the president is doing, we talked about this before, and I said I thought this was negotiating a ploy. I think I'm more convinced of that. I mean, Republicans and industrialists are all wanting this not to happen. Wall Street is reacting negatively to the prospects of this happening. So, you know, I think the issue for the president is border and immigration. Not the the issue that he's using, which is tariffs. So he's, of course, linking those two and trying to get Mexico to stop persons from coming across the border. I think that's a negotiating plan.
You know, one of the things that is interesting to me about these so-called negotiations is how can a country honestly believe that they're negotiating in good faith when Trump has backed out of the Iran deal? And I thought that NAFTA, one of the whole points of NAFTA was to do away with the tariff imbalance between the United States and Mexico. I think NAFTA was supposed to be a no-tariff deal. Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That was the whole point, at least as the president campaigned to get rid of NAFTA, was that the tariffs were having a worse effect on the U.S., than on other countries, that the U.S. was as at a disadvantage, and the renegotiation would be to eliminate those tariffs.
And I bring up NAFTA because the new agreement has not been ratified, so NAFTA is still in place. So once again, you have the United States backing out of deals that the United States has signed. So I guess it's a rhetorical question. I don't understand how countries can think that they're negotiating with us in good faith.
Well, I think you're right. And one thing to remember is that the president is doing this under a national emergency because tariffs have to be approved by the Congress. But if he does these tariff changes as a result of a national emergency, then he can do it on his own without congressional approval.
My point to that point was not questioning how he can do it. It's that he's just violating the terms of NAFTA. That's all.
Well, that's true. I guess my point was he's violating it, but within the U.S. framework, he's still legally
correct.
Able to do this. If he declares a national emergency now,
right.
The national emergency that he's declaring is
also questionable.
National emergency. Exactly. Exactly.
In fact, you've got even Republicans that are now coming up and saying the basis upon which his declaring this national emergency is not what the law that he's using was intended for. It was intended to deal with countries such as China and countries such as North Korea and or Iran, but it was no way supposed to be used to declare a national emergency on our southern border with an ally like Mexico.
And not for trade. If you remember,
right.
I think your listeners remember that the first invocation of the national emergency was to build a wall.
Right.
Republicans were not in opposition to that. But now he's declaring a national emergency on tariffs, and that's going to affect business. And so, you know, his use of national emergency was not just limited to his pet project of the wall. It's now anything he doesn't like, he will declare a national emergency on.
What I thought was a very, very good graphic piece in the New York Times today about which states will be hit hardest by Trump's tariff on Mexico. And this is a map of the United States, which shows the total 2018 imports from Mexico to each state. And it shows which states, by the fact, had the greatest imports from Mexico would then be hardest hit by the tariffs on Mexico. President Trump's plan to force Mexico to take a tougher approach to enforcement of its border by ramping up tariffs on its products will ripple through the United States, with consumers around the country paying more for cars, TVs, blue jeans, beer, fresh vegetable, and other products. Your thought on, first of all, the accuracy of this portrayal or presentation, and as an economist, your thoughts on the New York Times analysis?
Yeah, I think the New York Times analysis is right on with the states that will be hit hardest by tariffs in terms of the states that have the greatest importing relationship with Mexico. And, you know, those states are, you know, the hardest hit in this analysis is Texas, which is not something that Republicans would want to happen. But in addition, you have California, which as a blue state, Republicans could care less about. You also have states in this map of Pennsylvania, Ohio, Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Those states that you know, went for Trump and put him over the top in the election. And so those are, you know, the president certainly doesn't want to hurt Texas, even if the trade-off is hurting New York and California. There's also another map of this, which of this analysis, which looks at jobs instead of a percentage of imports.
Mm-hmm.
And in that analysis, which is analysis actually from Deutsche Bank, Texas is again hit very hard in terms of jobs that would be threatened by the trade war. California and New York would be hit, but also those same states of Pennsylvania, Ohio, Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin would be heavily hit, as well as Florida, Georgia, and I believe North Carolina. So, you know, these are heavily Republican states, typically blue states or red states, or the swing states that Republicans have to be concerned with in the 2020 election. So this tariff is going to, like the trade war with on the soybeans with China, the effect of this trade war with Mexico is going to hurt particularly Republican constituents.
I wanted to get to a China soybean question in just a second, but I wanted to look at a couple of the categories that are listed here in this Times article, specifically cars and fresh vegetables. Because when you start hitting people at the dinner table, that transcends political ideology. When my tomatoes and my lettuce, the avocados for my guacamole, when all that starts going up because of tariffs, people really get angry. And people in this country have to do two things. They got to eat and they got to drive their cars. And the one, of course, that's near and dear to my heart is beer. You mess with my beer, and I'm a pretty angry guy. But when you look at cars, when you look at vegetables and other products that hit the dinner table, that to me is turbulent water.
That's correct. But in terms of dollar amounts, the vegetables, the fruits and vegetables are significant in volume, but not as significant in overall cost or pricing as cars and car parts and trucks and computers and at least equipment.
Well, let me ask you this question. Not in terms of bottom line dollar, but in terms of percentage of increase. So when I go to the grocery store, and I'll just make up a number, I'm used to paying 30 cents a pound for a tomato. And then all of a sudden that tomato is now 55 cents a pound. I go, wait a minute, that right there is an incredible increase. So the percentage, go ahead. I made my point. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the percentage on goods like fruits and vegetables, I mean, these are things that people go to the store every day and buy.
Right.
You don't go and buy a car every day.
True.
And if the price of a car goes up, substantially, maybe you decide to keep your old car a little longer. But you can't do that with fruits and vegetables. You can't do that with necessities.
Right.
And so there's an ability for people to to get around perhaps the increases in cars and car parts, but not in terms of fruits and veggies and those kind of things. So that's where the effect will be seen greatest. And in addition, that effect is greatest on the poor,
mm-hmm.
and on the middle class, because they spend a larger part of their income on those types of things.
That was going to be my next point. Thank you very much for taking me there. Now, quickly to the Chinese and the soybean conversation. Because it's been very interesting watching how surgically China has responded to the U.S. imposition of tariffs on Chinese goods, and China saying, we're not placing any new orders for American soybeans. We're going to Brazil.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there was a very surgical strike. It was probably really unexpected by the Trump administration when they got into this trade war, that their constituents, Midwest farmers in particular, would be hit very hard by a Chinese response. I guess you had to expect the Chinese to respond, but to respond so surgically was probably not something that was thought about. And in addition, I guess there's talk that the next round, if this continues, the next round for China would be to target what are called rare earth metals.
Yes.
These are metals that are important in electronics. They're important in industrial materials, and they're important in national defense. And so, the U.S. buys a lot of its national defense products, or at least raw materials, from China, which is a possible now second round of retaliation from China. And so, it's interesting. You could declare a national emergency based on national defense and end up doing things that actually hurt the national defense. I mean, this is not well thought out.
Your cell phones can't work. You can't talk to your guided missiles. There are a lot of defense-related implications when China starts either raising the prices on those rare earth minerals or limiting your access to them.
That's correct. And one thing also, those rare earth elements, as I understand it, are used in, let's say, wind turbines for alternative energy production.
Hmm.
China leads the world in alternative energy production in terms of wind and solar. And they can continue to do that and put the U.S. at a disadvantage in advancing in those areas by restricting rare earth elements. So
the final area I wanted to get to, there was another piece today, how China tariffs could make your sweaters and pants cost more. The Trump administration's threat to impose new tariffs on nearly everything that comes to the United States from China has sent American retailers scrambling. Many rely on China for some portion of their manufacturing, and the new tariffs, as much as 25% on the roughly $300 billion worth of goods that so far have been untouched by the trade war, could force the companies to change where and how they make their products. And one of the things that jumped out at me, in fact, I was reading this as it related going back to the soybeans, that there were articles that were saying that once American farmers lose this China soy market, it'll be very difficult for them to reclaim access to those markets. That once China starts buying its soybeans from Brazil, it's not going to be just flipping a switch and getting China to come back. And so I'm thinking the parallel here is that once many who rely on China for a portion of their manufacturing for these clothing goods, it's going to have a similar type of effect.
Well, you're correct. I mean, once Brazil, for example, ramped up to supply Chinese soybeans, they begin to, their industry, soybean industry, begins to grow, and it actually becomes cheaper for them to produce more and more soybeans, which means their prices, if the U.S. Were to get an opportunity, U.S. farmers were to get an opportunity to compete against Brazilian soybeans, those Brazilian soybeans would be much cheaper. And the same thing would happen with China if those manufacturers that are now in China move out to
Vietnam,
lower costs, Vietnam or lower costs. It would be difficult to get those for China to compete against those. But I think China has more flexibility in terms of wages than the U.S. has in, with wages for soybean farmers. I mean, you know. The Chinese population, I won't say is used to low wages, but they would simply respond by lowering their wages in order to compete. U.S. farmers, if they lowered their revenue too much, they would just be out of business.
And that has that goes to a great degree on how the Chinese government manages its economy compared to how the United States government manages its economy.
Well, China is an authoritarian country. And therefore, if citizens are hurt by Chinese government policy, well, they'll just simply suck it up and continue on. U.S. farmers are not likely to want to continue being hit by problems with Trump trade policy and simply suck it up. I mean, they may do it for a while, but when they're out of business, there's no social safety net. Nothing to hold them up. They will eventually need to make some other decisions about how they're going to make a livelihood.
And to your point, Chinese nationalism plays a big part in that, being able to suck it up, as President Xi has talked about being prepared for the long march. Chinese people know what that means.
Exactly.
And there is no American parallel such as the long cattle drive. President Trump can't say, we got to be prepared for the long cattle drive. The farmers don't understand what that means.
Right. Well, so far they have, but there's been some dissension in the ranks of folks who are trying to stick with Trump, because the things that he promised would happen, that this would be easy. He said a trade war would be easy.
Right.
Well, it hasn't been easy. There's also one other thing that China has. The Chinese own over $1 trillion of U.S.
debt
in terms of government bonds.
Right.
And, so that gives them some leverage as well. So, after the rare earths, there's even that third
rail
thing that they could use. Right, third rail.
So, wow. Okay, well. Thank you, as always, Dr. Linwood Tahid. Thank you, Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Thank you so much for your time. I'm really liking the fact you're becoming a regular guest here, and I look forward to having you back.
Look forward as well, and thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Great story in Mint Press by Alexander Rubenstein. Following U.S. lead on Assange. Australia goes on assault spree against free press. The current Australian crackdown follows the example of the United States in its charges against an attempt to extradite Assange. Since the United States charged journalist Julian Assange with 17 counts of Espionage Act violation, charges that could see Assange facing the death penalty, Australia appears to be following America's lead in crackdown on free press, particularly journalists and publications that publish government secrets. Alexander Rubenstein, how so?
Well, what we're seeing in Australia in the past couple of days is really mind-blowing for me. I mean, we tend to think of Australia as, you know, one of the leading global democracies, but I mean, this is like straight out of like a military dictatorship, what's been happening. There's been at least two raids in as many days, and at least three investigations against journalists and publications have come to light. I think it's really important to note that Australia is a member of Five Eyes, which is like a global spying alliance, and have access to incredible surveillance powers through that. And actually, one of the first raid was against a journalist at her home. Her name is Annika Smethurst. And what she did was, a year ago, she published an article with leaked correspondences between, I believe it was the head of the Justice Department and the military. And these correspondences showed that they were basically proposing a policy for the agency in Australia, which is basically the equivalent of the National Security Agency in the U.S. And what this policy would do would be allow them to spy on their own citizens. And one thing that was really illuminating about this correspondence was the Home Affairs Secretary, I'm sorry, that was the one who was in the document, he said that their traditional law enforcement doesn't have the ability to spy on their own citizens, and instead they've been dependent on foreign partners to do that. So this is the story which sparked the first raid that we saw. I mean, clearly they were really upset about what happened. Honestly, I can't see it as anything other than punitive against the journalist, not even the whistleblower, because there's this new law in Australia from last year which allows for journalists to face charges for exposing government secrets, something that wasn't on the books prior.
And Assange is an Australian citizen. There are a lot of interesting dots that people, I think, need to start connecting here. You mentioned the Five Eyes, and just quickly, new documents from the cache of files leaked by Edward Snowden show that New Zealand's intelligence agency has been collecting in bulk the cell phone, email, and internet files of people across the Pacific Island nations and handing that data over to the U.S. NSA in an operation one angered lawmaker now describes as a giant vacuum cleaner of information. And when you start talking about collecting information in terms of collecting the bulk of the cell phone information, a lot of that technology in terms of spying through cell phones has been developed by Israel. So there are a lot of dots that can be connected here through just the one story that you wrote.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to note that New Zealand is also a Five Eyes member, but you're absolutely right about Israel being behind a lot of this technology. I mean, that's a story for another day, but some of the worst spyware has come from Israel. It's called Pegasus. I would encourage people to look that up. There's also technology which allows when you just plug your phone into it or a phone into it, and it totally extracts everything off the phone, even encrypted messages. So, and that's all from Israel, but I think that's a story for another day. That's multiple stories, actually.
You have a header here, as with Assange, journalist publisher may face prosecution for leaks. So talk about kind of the ominous indication that this tells us about what's on the horizon for journalists in this country.
Well, I mean, I think it's important to point out that the state's public broadcaster, it's called ABC, was also raided, and they stole, they had a warrant that allowed for them to add, delete, or alter files, and they wound up taking about 9,214 is the number. And there's also another investigation that's been opened into another journalist. He wasn't raided, but an investigation was opened after he reported on some refugee boats that he wasn't supposed to know about. So, you know, these raids, these investigations, coupled with this law that came out last year that allows for journalists to face charges for reporting on government secrets, really spell a pretty scary future for journalists in that country. And I would say not just in that country, but in a lot of Western countries, because these things don't happen in a vacuum. Obviously, there's coordination between these governments at the highest level. And I think that Assange was just the beginning. We're going to see a lot more people who report on national security secrets going to prison. And you can see from the comments from the prime minister that he's like totally okay with this. Scott Morrison, he was in London. And when he was asked about the raid, he said, "It never troubles me that our laws are being upheld." So, I mean, this is it's really disastrous. It's blatant affront to the free press. It's punitive. And I think that's a point that really shouldn't be that really should be emphasized, is the punitive nature. And it's totally counter to the way that Western democracies such as Australia and the United States like to brand themselves. And I would add that there was another raid just a few weeks prior to this in the United States in San Francisco against a journalist. I didn't get a chance to talk about that in my article, but I would also encourage people to look into that.
Yeah, we talked about, I don't recall his name at the moment, but he eventually did get his materials back. But to your point, he was raided and he was jailed for a brief time.
Yeah, this is just the beginning. I mean, we're going to see other countries doing similar things. We're going to see more raids in the United States. I would add that right now the United States is propping up a dictator who is president in violation of the constitution of Honduras. And the attacks on the free press there have been astounding. There was just a journalist 2 days ago who was sentenced to 37 days for confronting Juan Guaido's fake ambassador to his country. So, I mean, the pattern that we're seeing is that U.S. allies are getting away with these kinds of assaults with total impunity. And I think that Israel's worth mentioning in this context too, because they're constantly raiding Arab newspapers, their headquarters. I mean, Al Jazeera was bombed, I think. The Middle East Eye was raided. And yet we call Israel the only democracy in the Middle East. But again, this is just the beginning. It's not going to get any better from here. And I think that people really need to really do a lot more to spotlight the attacks on the free press. And I would add that that the NGOs that are the kind of like charge themselves with defense of their free press are pretty toothless in this regard.
And there's a reason that the First Amendment, a free press, is in the First Amendment, because that is the true protector of the democratic process, the democratic experiment.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, the First Amendment prevents the government from making any laws which would abridge the freedom of the press. And just the prosecution and, if it happens, conviction of Julian Assange would run in violation to that, because it would set precedent, which is law. So it would deliver a law into the United States books that says that publishing government secrets like that is illegal, and you will go to prison for it. And you could wind up going to prison for the rest of your life, and they may even end your life for it. So, I mean, that's the message that the U.S. is sending.
And let's just look at, without going into a whole lot of detail, but just to make the point, when you look at the so-called secrets that are being published, and again, going back to this article about the spy agencies use giant vacuum cleaner to collect data across the Pacific, new documents from the cache of files leaked by Edward Snowden. So they're trying to, under this whole pretext of national security and the war on terror, they're trying to put this in the context of Snowden giving this information to Julian Assange and Julian Assange disseminating this information through WikiLeaks, that somehow that's undermining national security. No, folks, they're telling you how your government is threatening your security and violating your privacy. Your thoughts there, Alexander Rubenstein?
Yeah, I mean, what these people are doing are public services. I mean, whether they're exposing war crimes or illegal surveillance, they are the ones that are bringing to light the lawlessness, the violations of the law. Let's not forget that the NSA was breaking U.S. law, was breaking the U.S. Constitution. And I think that it's telling that people like Chelsea Manning and people like Julian Assange are the ones going to prison while Trump is pardoning war criminals, actual war criminals, and has them in his administration. Elliot Abrams, he played a hand in war crimes in Guatemala. And so, I mean, this is just the double standard that we see with the Trump administration, but it's been going on before that. It's reaching a figurehead now, and one can only hope that with the next administration we'll see a reversal, but I'm actually a bit skeptical of that.
Alexander Rubenstein, staff writer for Mint Press News, based in Washington. He reports on police, prisons, and protests in the United States and the United States policing of the world. Previously reported for RT and Sputnik News. You are so gracious with your time when we call, Alex, man. Thank you so much. Great work.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be on. Thank you.
Really appreciate it. All right, folks. You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.